Welcome to Fronteras, a program about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Texas history is often centered on the Alamo and other important battles that led to Texas independence. If we look a little further to the South and Southwest, there's a rich Texas history that's undertold in the Rio Grande Valley. The Spanish arrived in what we know as the Valley and Tamaulipas region in the mid-18th century. They called it Nuevo Santander. Prior to European contact, at least 49 distinct indigenous groups populated the region. Spain, Mexico, and the U.S. competed for control of the lower Rio Grande Valley for more than a century. Mexicans and indigenous peoples who populated the region prior to and during these conquests are still feeling its repercussions today. Omar Valerio Jimenez is an associate professor of history at the University of Texas at San Antonio. Valerio Jimenez explores the history of this region in the book River of Hope, Forging Identity and Nation in the Rio Grande Borderlands. Valerio Jimenez was born in Matamoros, Mexico, across the border from Brownsville. He came to the U.S. at age 6 and grew up in the Valley and South Texas. Valerio Jimenez studied engineering in Massachusetts and didn't have much knowledge about Texas history other than what's taught in public schools. His attention was piqued when he learned about the Plan de San Diego, hatched during the Mexican Revolution.
So the Plan de San Diego was a somewhat radical plan that was created by some Tejanos, Mexican-Americans, Mexican-Texans in South Texas, to basically take over the U.S. Southwest and carve out a space for Mexicans, for Asians, for American Indians, and for African-Americans. And it was a result of experiencing years of discrimination, of anti-Mexican violence. And the creation of the plan has been disputed various times, various people. More importantly, I mean, it never got carried out, obviously, but it was partly a result of Mexican Americans being very much targeted and trying to exert their rights. And more importantly, for our purposes and in terms of our history purposes, the result was that there was this long period of state-sponsored violence against Mexicans, some of it carried out by the Texas Rangers. And that eventually led to, for example, Representative José T. Canales to launch this investigation, as he was a legislator from Brownsville, and he launched an investigation into the 1919 Texas Ranger investigation, where he basically was trying to rein in some of the abuses that the Texas Rangers were responsible for, targeting Mexicans. And this 1919 investigation didn't accomplish all its goals, but it accomplished some of its goals. And more importantly, it placed emphasis and it put a spotlight on the Texas Rangers and their abuses.
And this violence is, of course, evident in your book as it is focused on sort of the lower Rio Grande Valley that we know of now in Texas. But the native population that was here prior to the Spanish arriving, they saw, I don't know if they saw violence sort of on the same scale as they did under the Texas Rangers, but they were still oppressed by the newcomers, by the Spanish. And this was also the case when Mexico declared independence from Spain. And again, also when the United States, after the border was redrawn after the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, the population that has lived in what we now know as the border area has almost always been oppressed and reacted violently upon by many officials as well.
Right. And one of the things that my book covers is sort of these multiple levels of conquest. As you mentioned, the Spanish colonists who arrived in the area in 1749 to establish towns along the river called the Villas del Norte, they basically conquered, in many ways, the local indigenous populations. Many times they took captives, they forced some of these indigenous people to be domestic servants, or what they called at the time, criados, or slaves, domestic slaves. In this part of Texas, in the lower Rio Grande Valley, the Spanish colonists sort of conquered these indigenous people. And then after Mexican independence in 1821, things didn't really change much for the indigenous people, but one of the things that was a big change was the U.S.-Mexican War that occurred later. When I talk about this, my book, people mention, well, what was the effect of the Texas Revolution? And it had a minimal effect, but Texas claimed the area during the Texas Republic, but it didn't actually hold jurisdiction. So the towns from Laredo down to Matamoros, including Reynosa and Camargo, they still reported to Mexico during this whole time. So the towns in the so-called Nueces Strip, or the ranches, they were owned by Mexicanos, and those Mexicanos still considered themselves Mexican citizens after, you know, Mexican independence, even though Texas claimed all the area down to the Rio Grande. But after the U.S.-Mexican War, this then introduces sort of what I call the second conquest of the region, as Americans then conquered the area and ethnic Mexicans become conquered people like the indigenous people were.
I thought what was fascinating is when they were looking to redraw the boundaries, there were some who wanted to draw the boundary at the Nueces River. And then what you call the Nueces Strip, which is what I believe is between the Nueces and the Rio Grande. And some people wanted to push even further into Mexico, past the Rio Grande. But there were other people who wanted to just stop at the Rio because they did not want to incorporate too many more mongrels and Indians.
Right.
So the language that the Hispanic population is hearing more and more now from white supremacists, it hasn't changed at all, like in the last couple of centuries.
Right, right. And one of the things that I have mentioned in the past to my students is that, you know, anti-Mexican violence and anti-Mexican rhetoric has a very long history in the U.S. Probably the largest sort of instance of anti-Mexican violence occurred after the Texas Revolution. And it's going to happen again after the U.S.-Mexican War. After the Texas Revolution, one of the things that occurs is that Anglo-Texans or Anglo-Americans, like other people elsewhere in the world, they confuse a people with a government. And they confuse ethnic Mexicans or Tejanos, Mexican Texans, with the Mexican government. And they forget, not all of them, but some of them forget that some of Tejanos fought on the Texas side. During the Texas Revolution, another historian, Raul Ramos, at the University of Houston, has studied this, and he describes a process by which Tejanos during the Texas Revolution, many of them, most of them actually, tried to remain neutral. Some of them took sides, right? Some of them fought on the Texas side. Some of them fought on the Mexican side. There was actually in San Antonio brothers who fought on opposite sides. But both the Texas rebels and the Mexican government did not like anyone to try to remain neutral. So there was always this idea of you're either with us or you're against us. And so if Tejanos tried to remain neutral, Anglo-Texans believed at the time and then afterwards, after the Texas Revolution, that if they didn't fight on the Texas side, they must have been on Mexican side. They could only envision two choices, right? Either for or against. They couldn't envision neutrality. And the Mexican government's the same way. And so it put a lot of Tejanos in a very uncomfortable situation. But anyway, one of the most famous episodes of anti-Mexican violence, for example, immediately after the Texas Revolution, was directed against Juan Seguin, the last mayor of San Antonio of Mexican descent, in the 19th century. And I tell my students there wasn't another mayor of Mexican descent until Henry Cisneros became mayor in the 1980s of San Antonio. He was mayor at the time, and he had to flee because there were some Mexican people living in San Antonio who went to him to appeal to him to say, there are squatters, there are vigilantes targeting us, they want us to leave our land because they believe that, you know, we fought on the Mexican side. And he tried to help them, and because he tried to help them, there were death threats directed against him and his family, and so he had to flee to Mexico as a sitting mayor. And so if you can imagine that an elected official was so threatened by Anglo-Texan vigilantes, you can imagine what would happen with non-elected officials, you know, your common Tejano. That happened during the Texas Revolution. It happened during the whole period of the Texas Republic. Actually, the population of central Texas and eastern Texas, the Tejano population, many of them ended up moving to the South Texas area where there was more Tejanos for protection or moving to Mexico, what would today would be Mexico. And the same thing's going to happen during the U.S.-Mexican War. And so this anti-Mexican rhetoric is many times promoted by people who don't really understand the situation of how Mexicans, how Tejanos had helped people like, you know, Stephen F. Austin and Moses Austin and so forth. So right before the Texas Revolution, a lot of newcomers came from other parts of the U.S., from the South, And many of those newcomers weren't as familiar with sort of Tejano-Anglo relations as the ones who had been here for a while, like the Austins. And so they came and sort of had these other preconceived ideas about, you know, people of color. And one of the things that scholars today have talked about is sort of racial formations and how many times if people who were coming from Tennessee, who were coming from Louisiana, had never encountered a Mexican then, and they encounter Mexicans in Texas by moving here, well, how do they relate to them? They relate to them how, in similar ways that they've related to African Americans, because those are the other people of color they've had, you know, experience with. They relate to them in a negative way, and they definitely don't see them as equals. And I think the quote that you were referring to was actually the kind of language that congressmen used during debates in Congress while the U.S.-Mexican War was going on, and they were trying to decide how much of Mexico were we going to acquire as a result of this war. And many of them believed we should acquire all of Mexico, and then there were some who opposed that and said no, because what are we going to do with all these, you know, mongrel people, all these people who are people of color? We already have a so-called problem with the color line with African Americans, and now we're going to incorporate more. And so in the end, they incorporated sort of the northern half of Mexico, where it was believed there was fewer of these mongrel people. And there was definitely less populated than central Mexico, but there were still many indigenous people and Mexicanos.
We're talking with Omar Valerio Jimenez, Associate Professor of History at the University of Texas at San Antonio. He's a native of the borderlands and is author of River of Hope, Forging Identity and Nation in the Rio Grande Borderlands. When we come back, an accusation made against Mexicans and Mexican Texans along the border in the 19th century is still heard today.
You'd think that someone's going to cross the border illegally just for the purposes of voting.
Voter fraud, cattle theft, and anti-Mexican rhetoric. More with Omar Valerio Jimenez is next on Fronteras. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Anti-Mexican rhetoric was highlighted recently in the news when a white man said he drove over 600 miles to kill Mexicans in El Paso. He claimed Texas was being invaded. The invasion began hundreds of years ago when Spaniards settled the Southwest and when Anglo-Americans began pushing into Texas prior to the Texas Revolution and after the state joined the Union in 1845. People of color along the border and in the Rio Grande Valley during those times became targets of racism by the newcomers. One settler to the region wrote in the 1840s that manifest destiny would change the landscape for the better. She wrote, quote, "It was that of an old race passing away, a new race pressing on its departing footsteps, a new scene in the history of the country, a possession by conquest," end quote. And criminal activity of any kind was biased against Tejanos in the region. Newspapers were guiltiest of spreading stereotypes. The Brownsville paper, the Fort Brown Flag, wrote of one murder, quote, "The murderous mode of the procedure was purely Mexican," end quote. Another publication wrote, "3/4 of our population consists of Mexican pelados, born, bred, and matured thieves. They infest the alleys day and night," end quote. Journalists wrote that Tejanos looked like monsters, greasers, and demons. Omar Valerio Jimenez writes about this in his book River of Hope, Forging Identity and Nation in the Rio Grande Borderlands. He says some of those articles made their way beyond the border to parts of the U.S. that were unfamiliar with the border and established stereotypes that linger today.
The popularity sort of anti-Mexican views sort of soared after the Texas Revolution, partly because the people who participated in the Texas Revolution, Anglo-Texans, wrote about their account. They wrote these little accounts of what had happened. And, you know, they, for instance, emphasized the Battle of the Alamo and how barbarous, you know, Santa Anna had been and so forth. And so for many people living in Massachusetts, living in Maine, living in New York, the first time they heard of Mexicans was in a very negative way because they had been the so-called enemy. And there was no mention in any of these pamphlets or little books that there was people like Seguin, like De Zavala, who actually fought on the Texas side.
And you also reference in your book, you know, a lot of those articles influenced a lot of juries because Mexicans and Mexican Texans at the time also had a reputation of being criminals and bandits. It didn't matter whether or not they'd been convicted or not, or whether or not they even actually did the deed. Just the fact that these articles are already referencing to them as criminals and bandits, that already is prejudicing jurors.
Exactly. One of the things that I found was I started looking at criminal cases. After the U.S. takes over in 1848, South Texas is now ruled by U.S. law, and so therefore U.S. courts take over, and so district courts, local municipal courts, are now being run according to U.S. law. And so I started looking at these criminal cases and seeing how Mexicans were being tried and convicted and then sentenced. And one of the things I realized is that many times Mexicans received higher punishments for a similar crime. Like one of the biggest crimes, one of the most common crimes in the mid-19th century was to steal cattle, because it was very easy to do. It was very common. They were valuable, and you could sell it really quickly. The cattle thieves were Indians, were Mexicans, were Anglo-Texans, you know, African-Americans in some cases. But in South Texas, when newspapers reported on these crimes, it was always assumed that the bandits, the rustlers, were Mexicans or Indians. And I looked at similar cases of cattle theft. And in one really egregious case, there was a group of Anglo-Texans who were caught stealing cattle, and they were basically given a very light sentence. And the trial transcripts showed that the judge was very much trying to help them. And it just showed me that justice at the time wasn't blind. People today say that justice isn't blind, but there was a racial component to it. People's preconceived notions of the criminality or the so-called criminality of a population influences their decision. And so in some cases, there were mainly Anglo-Texan jurors and a few Tejanos, and they routinely issued pretty harsh sentences to Mexicanos and to African-Americans and Indians. And so the penitentiaries had very large numbers of African-Americans, even in the 19th century, and of Tejanos, disproportionate to their population in Texas.
So what I thought was really interesting in your book is that a lot of the Mexican Texans, you know, they're U.S. citizens when the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo after the U.S.-Mexican War, Mexicans who found themselves on the U.S. side of the Rio Grande could claim U.S. citizenship. Therefore, that would make them eligible to become voters. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, politicians in particular, would often court this population because they needed the votes. Mm-hmm. But when they would lose, they would blame illegal voting, you know, bringing people in from Mexico to vote illegally, etc. And it made me think a lot of this vote tampering drama that happened after the election, the Trump administration claiming that so many millions of people voted illegally. And what I read in your book made me immediately think of that.
Right. One of the things that I have found is in writing this book is that many of the patterns, many of the processes that began in the 19th century continue today. And one of those patterns, you know, one of the negative patterns is accusing Mexicans of voter fraud. And so what you're referring to is politicians, usually it was Anglo-Texan politicians, courting Mexican voters. And sometimes there was two Anglo-Texan politicians running against one another. And whoever lost would often, even though they themselves had courted the Mexican vote beforehand, the Mexican-Texan vote, if they lost, they would accuse the winning candidate of having imported voters from Mexico. This was happened over and over in the 19th century. And I just mentioned a few cases. When I was writing this book, this was going on even before the Trump election. There was these charges of people along the border, counties along the border, but definitely states along the border, of politicians trying to bring in voters from Mexico to vote. And just that charge by itself, even if people don't know the history, is sort of outlandish. You'd think that someone's going to cross the border illegally just for the purposes of voting. If you think about it just rationally, it seems like they're going to risk a lot just to vote. And even if they were getting paid to do so, I mean, you know, that's risking a lot. I think they're going to cross the border illegally for other reasons, but I don't think they're doing it to vote. Just as Mexicans were being accused of supposedly not being citizens and voting, then when the Civil War breaks out, there's an instance that I thought was just a great use of sort of this Anglo-American or Anglo-Texan charge, like, oh, you're not really valid citizens here. Texas declared for the Confederacy, and so they, at one point they instituted the Confederate draft in Texas. They instituted a draft. And so there's reports in the newspapers of Confederate draft agents going around to ranches in Texas and trying to draft Tejanos into the Confederate Army. And there's reports of these agents saying, well, everywhere we go, everyone claims that they're not citizens. They're not U.S. citizens, and therefore they're exempt from the draft. What I saw that, you know, I read between the lines, and I thought, well, here's Tejanos who for years have been told, you're not a citizen. We're not going to allow you to vote. We're not going to allow you to be on juries and so forth. And now that Texas needs them to be in the military, they're claiming we're not U.S. citizens, and therefore we're exempt from the draft. And I thought it was just a very unique way of sort of turning the tables here. But despite that, the Union and Confederate armies drafted Tejanos. The Confederate Army drafted them in Texas, but they recruited them on both sides.
Omar Valerio Jimenez is an associate professor of history at the University of Texas at San Antonio and is the author of River of Hope, Forging Identity and Nation in the Rio Grande Borderlands. Our conversation continued for several more minutes, and you can hear it next week. Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org, and wherever you get your podcasts. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Lauren Terrazas. Our executive producer is Dan Katz. Our digital content producer is Bree Kirkham. And our editor is Fernando Ortiz Jr. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.